We always have so many things to tell our audience about here at Intelligence Squared. So when I'm needing a top-down view of it all, I don't want to feel like I'm looking at organized chaos. That's why I really love Notion, which lays out different threads of work in a beautifully designed layout. And despite all of its clever AI tech going on in the background, it feels as clear and easy as putting pen to paper. Remember that? But with Notion, you can do a lot more than jot down a few thoughts. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. And thanks to its AI-powered model, the way it works is so intuitive, every question has an answer. I still love my paper notebook, but sitting next to Notion, it might need to up its game a little bit. Try Notion for free and up your game too when you go to notion.com/squared. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/squared, lowercase. So you can start turning ideas into action. And when you use the link, you're supporting Intelligence Squared too. That's notion.com/squared.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
If you love the Intelligence Squared podcast, you can support the show and help us do what we do by hitting subscribe via Apple Podcasts. And in return, you'll get bonus content, ad-free listening, and early episodes too.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. On today's show, Robin Dunbar, the influential academic and author, discusses his new book, which explores the psychology of religion. Why do so many of us have the desire to believe? Robin Dunbar is Emeritus Professor of Evolutionary Psychology at Oxford University. For the past 50 years, he's specialised in anthropology and psychology, focusing mostly on primate behaviour and cognitive function in humans to try and learn just why we behave in the ways we do. He's also the person who came up with the Dunbar number, the theory that humans can only really maintain around 150 connections at once. Think about how many people you actively check in with on social media rather than passively follow, and you can start to see he may have a point. His latest book is How Religion Evolved and Why It Endures, which studies the psychology that underpins why faith is such an integral part of human society. Joining Robin in conversation is Stuart Ritchie, psychologist at King's College London and author of Science Fictions. Here's Stuart with more.
Welcome, Robin. Very much enjoyed reading your book. Perhaps to start off before the book, though, many people will be familiar with you from Dunbar's number, the number 150, and your studies of social groups. I wonder if you can give us a little bit of background into them, and then we'll kind of see how that builds a foundation for your theory of how religion evolved.
Okay, so Dunbar's number is really, I guess the simplest way of thinking about it is that it's the limit on the number of relationships that you can manage at any one time. That's to say friendship and family relationships broadly. It came off, the back of a prediction from group size plotted against brain size in monkeys and apes. And that equation, the regression equation for that, made a prediction of about 150 as being what we'd expect for humans. And slightly to my astonishment, just turned out when I started looking for data on natural human group sizes to be about right. And over the last 25 years, I suppose, since I first suggested this crazy idea, we've accumulated really quite a lot of empirical evidence to suggest that this really is true. And what's odd in a way is it turns out to be not only your natural social world, if you like, the number of friends and family that you have. So that's looking at the world bottom up from your perspective, embedded into a wider community. But it also turns out to be a natural grouping size for human groups or human organizations. So hunter-gatherer, social organizations, or the optimal size for military units, for example, or the optimal size for business organizations. There are all sorts of kinds of weird and wonderful, in some cases, data sets that we've come across, or people have sent to me which point to this number about 150, give or take a bit, as being kind of deeply bound into our natural psychology, if you like. It's there in the brain. It's almost as though you have 150 slots in your mind for relationships. Not a memory problem, it's managing those relationships. That's the key.
Are there individual differences in this number? I mean, we hear about the number 150, but is it the case that some people who are more extroverted, that they have more of the slots, and some people who are more introverted have fewer? Is that how this works? Or is it really kind of a kind of a ceiling that people hit up against, and it's just a kind of a human universal?
It's a kind of general ceiling, but there's a lot of variation around that. And we know quite a lot about what causes that variation. It is indeed due to personality differences. So extroverts, as you might well imagine, have more people in their circle of friends, in particular friends and family. Introverts tend to have fewer. There's a very strong age effect. So the size of this number increases, I suppose, from birth up through childhood and teenage years. It reaches a sort of peak somewhere around about 200, 250 in the late teens, early 20s, probably the early 20s, actually. And then from about the mid-20s onwards, it stabilizes, well, it drops and then stabilizes very consistently about 150. And then I'm afraid once you get beyond my age, which is clearly always going to be next year, as far as I'm concerned, it starts to decline inexorably as you age. There are gender effects, although probably not so much in the total number. There are quite strong gender effects in the size of the subgroupings that make up the 150, which we might come back to later. But essentially, you know, it's a sort of broad picture. Certainly from an organizational point of view, there isn't much freedom of movement, because 150 turns out mathematically to be an ideal number for information flow around networks. Either side of that, and in quite a narrow band either side of that, efficiency falls away very dramatically, it turns out.
I think we should have a disclaimer at the start, which is we're going to talk about why religion evolved. We're going to talk about religion as if we were, you know, Martian social scientists who are just observing this human behavior. And we're not necessarily making any claims about the truth value of any particular religion. A religious person might tell you that religion evolved because it's true, right? Maybe it took us a while to get to the one true religion, which happens to be the one that they were brought up in. But in this case, it doesn't matter what your personal views are. So we're coming at it as kind of outsider scientists. That's your approach that you're taking. Am I correct?
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. So you start off the book by mentioning that there are lots of theories of religion, from psychological perspectives, from social perspectives, sometimes even from political perspectives. Karl Marx talks about the religion as the opiate of the masses, and so on. Could you describe some of those previous theories, and then and what they lack, and what it is that you've added with this new book about the evolution of religion?
I think probably actually there have been two main kind of dimensions that people have explored. One is obviously the kind of beliefs and theology of religion, and the other is the psychology, particularly in the last 20 years, maybe, what's become known as the cognitive science of religion. I mean, I'm not going to discuss at all, really, the beliefs component, although there are some interesting questions to ask about, you know, when do certain kinds of beliefs appear in the course of human evolution. But the cognitive science of religion tends to focus on the preset of the human mind for responding to certain kinds of things. So this is a very mechanistic view of religiosity, perhaps, is the way to think about it, your tendency to be religious. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's all probably beaten gravy to the story of religion as much as anything is. The pitch I've taken, though, is to sort of, in a way, to step back to a much earlier anthropological social sciences tradition, the Durkheimian tradition, say, actually, well, you know, it's not so much the issue of the sort of mind's design per se for absorbing and accepting religious ideas, but the way in which religion creates this sense of community bonding that's actually important. And that's a consequence of the kinds of religion rituals that religions engage in, and these rituals are kind of universal. You see them in pretty much all religions, maybe not all of them in every religion, but certainly as a sort of set of activities. It's that sense of religion as an activity, and that the reason that's important then is it creates this sense of belonging, and it does it through what I've called the mystical stance, which is this sense of a direct communication between your mind and the divine mind. And you see this over and over again, but it's a feature of religions that's particularly prominent in what we might call more primitive animist type religions, so shamanism and things like that. So that, you know, this sense and that sense of awe and wonder and excitement that's created by this apparent ability to engage directly with the mind of God, if you like, seems to be very, very important. And I think it points to the fact that you don't join a religion. Well, you can grow up in a religion and come to believe the particular beliefs, but you don't join a religion because of its beliefs. You join a religion because of the kind of raw feels you have of the experiences that you get during services and so on.
It's very much your theory that religion is adaptive then, and not some kind of either neutral thing that just kind of came along with evolution of the mind, or actually a maladaptive kind of bad byproduct. It's actually your view that an evolutionarily adaptive thing. So is it the case then that religious people are better off in terms of their physical or mental health, or that they're more pro-social? Can you just summarize some of the evidence on that, which you do in the book?
I think the burden of the evidence really comes down to the fact that there's a fairly consistent tendency for actively religious people, say people who go regularly to services and take part regularly, to be happier, feel more satisfied with their lives, to be able to cope with the vicissitudes of life, the traumas that life insists on throwing at you one way and another. That they also tend to be healthier on the whole, perhaps to recover more quickly from diseases or from things like surgery or something like that, and in general to live longer probably. And I suppose the bad news is for non-religious people, they actually die more happily.
For me personally, somewhat bad news indeed. But although I suppose there's a caveat to some of that, which is that when it comes to the sort of social aspects, my reading of the evidence is that religious people are, yes, they're healthier physically and mentally, and indeed they are fitter in the evolutionary sense because they have higher levels of fertility and so on. But the kind of the outward benefits, the pro-sociality, does apply only to the in-group. It's a kind of a focused thing, which I guess fits very well with your theory, rather than just being more pro-social in general and creating a kind of a better world for all humanity.
Yeah. I suppose I was taking the line just then really in terms of the kinds of direct fitness benefits that has prompted in general the cognitive science of religion folk to take the view that there are none. Or there appear to be none, and therefore religion is a kind of aberration of how the mind is designed for other perfectly good evolutionary reasons. And I guess I'm just making a pitch to say, well, actually, it's not quite true. It turns out, I mean, when they made those claims, I think there was not a great deal of evidence to that effect. But I think we've accumulated enough evidence to see that there are direct personal benefits. That said, I don't think those personal benefits are the reasons that evolution has driven religion or religiosity to occur. The reason religiosity and therefore religions have evolved in the course of human evolution relate, I think, much more explicitly to the social functions of community, essentially community cohesion, of building this sense of belonging of the in-group in the context of the many external threats that all primates in general, all born animals, I suppose, have to face in the world in which they live. That's to say, predators on the one hand, and particularly in species like perhaps primates, certainly the great apes, but most particularly humans, raiders from the next door valley, you know, and raiders are really just predators of another kind to all intents and purposes. Either way, mammals' general response to these kind of external threats is to clump together in groups. And the issue is, how do you create these bonded groups that will stick together through thick and thin and not sort of wander off because they've noticed, you know, particularly green patch across the other side of the river and abandon your friends, abandon you, you know, for cavalier reasons like that.
Now, at this point, perhaps I should bring up an issue which you talk about in, very early in the book, and it comes up again towards the end, about a scientific heresy, which is the idea of group selection. Now, it sounds sometimes when you talk about groups and benefits to the group and so on, that you might be talking about this idea of group selection, which for anyone who isn't familiar, is a kind of a highly controversial and indeed, I think, very, very minority theory in the evolution of biology, where groups are the unit of evolution rather than genes. So normally when we think about evolution, Darwinian evolution, we think about kin selection. So you're trying to benefit the genes that you're carrying, and that means that you benefit people who also carry your genes, and you can be altruistic to them, but not necessarily that it happens to groups. And when we talk about groups, I think it is very easy to slip into a group selection sort of mentality. And I wonder if we can maybe just kind of anticipate and debunk that idea before we get into talking about the benefits in groups.
So group selection is indeed the great heresy in evolutionary biology, for which, you know, one normally gets flagellated for even mentioning it. And the reason, the problem with it is not so much, if you like, the concept, in the sense that famously there must be the circumstances under which it could occur will occur somewhere in the universe, but it is going to be extremely rare. It requires very, very specific circumstances to occur. And in this context, what we're referring to is evolution for the good of the species or evolution for the good of the group, the particular group you happen to be in. And kind of cultural evolution has been seen as a possible version of that. But the problem is, all the evidence where people have tried to test for these group selection effects gives negative results. It doesn't seem really to work sufficiently often to be your first port of call. However, what people have kind of begun to realize in maybe the last 20 years only is that with these very social animals, and particularly the social mammals like primates, forming a coherent, cohesive, bonded social group becomes part and parcel of their individual strategies for survival and successful reproduction. So the group itself provides benefits, but it's not the level at which evolution's occurring. Those benefits feed back down to the individuals. And I suppose the obvious example of this really is cooperative hunting by, you know, sort of big predators like hyenas or lions, where by ganging together, they can bring down a much, much bigger animal so that than they could if they hunted on their own. So there is a benefit by cooperating to produce a bigger return that everybody benefits from. Now, this has come to be known as group augmentation selection or group level selection, in the sense that there are benefits to be gained by cooperating with other individuals in social groups, but still the evolutionary cost accounting is being done at the level of the genes. Here, the problem with cooperation is that, you know, it involves the infamous problem that if you hang back, you know, somebody else pays the cost for you and you double benefit. But in this context of just grouping together for protection, that doesn't arise. You either join the group or you don't. There's no cost to be paid in terms of or additional cost to be paid that you can forego. So it obviates that whole problem that has bedeviled the evolution of cooperation.
Great. So let's talk about the mystical stance. So it's part of your theory that modern religions, doctrinal religions, you call them, have a kind of vestige of the more ancient types of religion with, still within them. And that involves the sort of the ritual, the dancing, the singing, the fasting, and so on. And you talk quite a bit in that section about endorphins. So I wonder if you could tell us how endorphins relate to the vestigial ritual elements of religion.
Okay, so the endorphins play a very seminal role in social bonding in primates as a whole. It's the main mechanism involved in social bonding. Endorphins are chemicals in the brain that are part of the brain's pain management system. They're opiates, hence the name. The endorphins is a contraction of endogenous morphine, meaning the body's own or brain's own morphine. Because chemically, endorphins are very similar to morphine, but the difference is it's just sufficient that we don't get addicted to them in the same way that we do to the more conventional opiates that, that play such havoc in our lives. But they act in the same sort of way. They give you this, when they're triggered, they give you this sense of relaxation and calmness and warmth and everything's well with the world and trust in the individuals you're with. And they create this sense of bondedness with those individuals. Now, primates trigger this system through social grooming, cleaning the fur and the hand movements as they part the fur and so on, trigger the endorphin system through a very specialized neural system. The problem with that is its intimacy means that it's a one-on-one activity, and that in turn sets a limit on the size of group you can bond. And that limit seems to be at about 50 individuals, which is the sort of typical biggest size that species of primates have. Now, when humans or our ancestors tried to evolve bigger groups leading up to our 150 in modern humans, they would have run up against this limitation. And the only way they could break through that glass ceiling was to find other ways of triggering the endorphin system. And it turns out lots of things do it. And they seem to have discovered a whole series of them, which actually now form our basic social toolkit. These are things like laughter, singing, dancing, telling emotional sob stories, eating and drinking together socially around the table, as it were. And in addition to that, it turns out that the rituals of religion also work in this same sort of way. All of these trigger the endorphin system. All of them, we've shown, enhance the sense of bonding. So we've actually gone into church services and evaluated the change in people's endorphins output from before the service to after, and a change in their sense of bonding, and shown that, during the course of services, this endorphin activation, and this creates this sense of belonging to the community. It depends on the level of activity. We did it on some sort of Afro-Caribbean Brazilian religions in Brazil, which are obviously full of singing and dancing and enormous fun. And a good bit of mysticism with trance, the sort of priests at the front sort of falling into trance and all that kind of stuff. And that really does the job superbly. But even the sort of conventional, modestly staid services of conventional Christian religions have the same effect. So it seems to have been a good mechanism that was hit on for creating this sense of belonging for larger than normal sized groups. And it seems to work extremely well on a mega scale.
And when the groups get even larger than that, when you talk about the kind of the whole history of religion and how it goes through all these stages, and as societies become agricultural, they take over larger amounts of land, they become larger, they become city states, they become countries, and so on. And your idea is then that they move from this kind of smaller group bonding to have some other control mechanism. And that control mechanism is the phrase you use is the moralizing high god. Can you tell us a bit about the moralizing high god?
Well, the big issue is that the transition created by the Neolithic, when people started living in villages. So what you find in hunter-gatherers universally, even today, is these kind of shamanic trance-based religions, often involving dance and singing. Hunter-gatherers live in very small groups, which allows them to kind of disperse the stresses of group living. Once you get into the Neolithic and people start living in villages, then the stresses of living in large groups, even of sort of 100 to 200 people, become very considerable. And that's when you see the first evidence for what we generally call doctrinal religions, in the sense they have some kind of theology and some kind of formal priesthood, rituals, temples, these kind of things that's visible in the archaeological record. There is a second phase that kicks in around about 2,000 to 3,000 years ago, in what's known as the Axial Age, when you have what are broadly referred to as the revealed religions, which are the big modern world religions as we have them, appear very rapidly all around the same time, essentially, over a period of 1,000 years, and in the same part of the world as well, in the same narrow latitudinal band, which is even more surprising, I think. And that seems to be associated with very large communities that have to be bonded, something in excess of 1 million people. So, small ancient empires, if you like, in a context where there was major social and political upheaval. So there seemed to have been a response to that.
And then this actually now intersects with another interest of mine, which is psychology and the improvement of psychological research. We're getting somewhat better at doing psychological research than we were a few decades ago. We've had the replication crisis and so on. And when I read Moralizing High Gods in your book, it triggered a memory of all these religious priming studies. And then I was very happy to find that a few pages later you say, well, actually, a lot of these studies haven't turned out very well. They've failed to replicate. They've not done so well. And these are studies where you get people they read about a god. Your god is watching you. They read a passage from the Bible or something, or they read something, and it primes. The idea is that it primes in their mind that there might be a god up there that's watching their behavior, and that they better control things. They better control themselves. And then when they go off to do a game with someone, it turns out they're more fair, or they're less likely to steal a cookie from the cookie jar, or whatever it is. Given that those studies haven't panned out, do you think the idea of, God is watching you and you need to control your behavior is weaker, or do you think it's just that those studies just were not adequate to really test the theory that you have here?
I think they're just looking in the wrong place. I mean, they're assuming that this is an all-encompassing effect. So if you take a random set of people and stick them in the lab and tell them God's watching them, they'll all respond to that. Well, of course, if half of them are atheists, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
But I think it probably is the case, although I'm not sure that anybody's actually really tested this anywhere. If you had some deeply religious people, then it would work. But it does, in this sense, I think it seems to form part of a suite of theological structures, you might call them, which give form and function to a particular set of beliefs, a particular religion, that make them work. And the whole purpose of it is to try and sort of make people better behaved in the context of the people, the rest of the community they live with, so that it doesn't break the community up, which is otherwise what will happen. If everybody goes around stealing the cookies from the cookie jar, eventually people are just going to stop living together. Live in their own caves, and that you lose the benefit of being in a community. So what you want is mechanisms to make people kind of just behave better. Well, I think, the real burden to that one is these emotional commitments that come out of the rituals and the performance, as it were, of religion, not the kind of theological, I suppose you might say, cognitive aspects of psychology per se, although clearly they will add gloss and polish to the effect. In other words, if you do a very careful experiment, you'll surely pick up some extra benefit being accrued by the fact that if people really believe that God is there and can see everything they do, even when nobody else can, then it is beneficial, and every little bit helps, as the advertisement says.
Would you like to support Intelligence Squared in what we do? Well, just hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts and you can listen to Intelligence Squared ad-free, enjoy exclusive bonus content, and get weekly episodes in advance too. Hit subscribe and we'll see you on the other side. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Now, time is ticking on, so we better move on to the second part of the book's title, which is Why Religion Endures. Now, we haven't had the results of the census yet. We filled in the census relatively recently, within the last year. We haven't had the results yet, but the prediction, I think, and we can discuss this, is that, you know, in the UK, religion will have declined. We'll have fewer people who are religious now. And that's generally been the case. You know, if you look broadly in kind of Western countries, there are some exceptions, but generally, if religion is this such an important aspect of society and such an important way to bond people together and so on, why is it that we're becoming less religious?
I guess this probably goes back as much as anything to a long-held perception in the whole history of religion, really. The religions are particularly active in contexts where there's a lot of strife and unpredictability. So when the environment is very unpredictable, or when you're subject to large quantities of raiding by people from elsewhere, or massive climate change triggering major movements of people around the globe, which has happened, you know, on many occasions in the past, then it kind of makes the, if you like, the, I suppose, the comforts of religion and also the bonding component of religion especially important. So at the one level, it's kind of making you feel better about, you know, these awful circumstances which you're having to cope with. But secondarily, it's also helping to bond the community to act as a defensive bulwark against these kind of effects. And I suppose it can cut both ways, because, you know, if the community is bonded together, they can go out and raid other people and help themselves to their food, preferentially to being raided by their next door neighbors. But, you know, I don't see any reason just to view that as unlikely, although there is some evidence to suggest that some psychological evidence suggests that people do become more religious in those sort of contexts, although these are, you know, kind of small scale experiments mostly.
So that would I suppose cover the tendency of, you know, if you look at the list of countries where there was a kind of global survey and people were asked how important is religion in your life. And the countries where religion is most important are probably, I would argue, and you can again disagree, probably places that we would rather not live. Somalia, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen are at the bottom, all the bottom of the list. And the countries where religion is less important are places like Japan, I think, is the very top of the list. Estonia, Sweden. And also there are also some kind of interactions with, you know, their communist countries. I think Vietnam is up very high there because, of course, religion was stamped out as part of a communist system. So, but it does. I wonder if this is maybe just asking the same question again. But think about Japan, where there aren't any moralizing high gods there. They have either Shintoism or Buddhism, or I think the majority of people have no religion at all. There are some rituals as part of those religions. You can watch them if you go to a shrine. You can watch the clapping ritual and the throwing a coin in and so on. But they certainly don't have a moralizing high god. And Japan is, of course, famously, notwithstanding the absolutely terrifying and tragic assassination of their ex-PM the other day, famously incredibly safe, low crime, high trust, and so on. So does that act as a kind of exception to your overall theory?
Not really, I think, in the sense that at least this is what I was told when I was in Japan, is that everybody is both Shinto and Buddhist. Mm. The two mix together seamlessly in an amazing sort of way, although clearly there are Shinto temples with Shinto priests and Buddhist temples with Buddhist priests. But everybody gets married by Shinto rituals. Everybody gets buried by Buddhist rituals. And when I asked why this was so, they said, well, it's kind of obvious because Shinto do much more exciting marriage rituals, but their burial rituals are thin and grim. And the Buddhists really do a good job on funerals, but their weddings are pretty uninspiring. But I think that's a sort of accident of history in a way. And I think it's probably helped. I don't know what the history of these two beliefs are going back through the centuries, as it were, whether they were much more in competition with each other at some point. But I think probably a lot of the sense of modern Japan probably comes out of the fact that you know, certainly after the end of the Second World War, but, you know, that was a bit of a blip, if you like, because they'd been doing pretty well right the way through the 20th century, from in terms of shipbuilding and sort of whiskey production, which was got in there very early on by some guys from Peterhead who had taken out there to start it. They've been in a very kind of good place economically and therefore socially right the way through. And I suspect that, you know, it's like a lot of these things that we still have here. We go through the motions in the Houses of Parliament. You have prayers said before, or, you know, if there's a big national event, you know, like a wedding, a royal wedding or coronation or something, you know, it's full of Anglican, full on Anglican service. And that's kind of just regarded as kind of a good and warm making thing to do. It gives one a feeling of being part of the community. And I suspect that plays a big role in the way Japan is. I mean, they still have lots of very weird and wonderful sects kicking around at the bottom, which are, you know, sort of neither Shinto nor Buddhist particularly. And very often those appeal to people who are at the bottom of the kind of economic and social scale.
Yeah. The last time I did an event for Intelligence Squared, it was about sex differences, specifically sex differences in the brain, but we also talked about psychology. You note in the book that the most well-replicated, most solid finding in psychology of religion is that females are more religious than males. Well, I suppose the first question is, why is that? And how does it relate to your overall theory?
It certainly seems to be true that women make up the bulk of congregations, particularly in fading religions, as it were. They just seem to be much more religious than men are generally. There has been an argument is that's related to the general kind of cognitive dimension that underpins these aspects of our social brain that run out into on the end of the male spectrum into the autistic spectrum, and that indeed autistic individuals, let's say high functioning autistic individuals of normal intelligence, really are very, very rarely religious in any kind of meaningful and active form. And so kind of males are, ordinary adult males, if you like, are just a few steps up from that. So they're a bit more religious, but they're still not as religious as women. Now, why that should be so is, I think there's no satisfactory explanation for, but my inclination is to point to the fact that women are much better at social cognitive skills than men are. So things like mentalizing or theory of mind, this ability to understand another individual's mind, to understand their intentions and why they're doing something, to ask, you know, well, why are they doing this? You know, these women are just much better at doing that, and as a result of that, they tend to have much bigger circles of friendship than men do. The interesting question, you know, that's kind of an explanation for the fact, and the question is, why should that be? And that, I think, is completely open to arguments still. I mean, one argument that could be deployed as a speculation is that there's a tendency for women to move on marriage in most agricultural societies, small scale societies, and in some hunter-gatherer societies it's a bit more variable there, but certainly in agricultural ones it's the women tend to move and live with them, and they arrive in a context where everybody is on the husband's side. They have no relatives in the community, and they just better getting on with or managing the social complexities of the social environment they're in, and therefore they need better skills. And that may just predispose them as a byproduct, conceivably, to be more religious. But it's hard to see any kind of obvious reason, really. And it's certainly a difficult one to test.
And that actually nicely brings us full circle, because another part of the why religion evolved theory that you have is this idea of understanding other people's minds, and the idea that as we evolved the ability, as our brains became bigger and more complex, we evolved the ability to hold in our mind more levels of intentionality, as you call it. So I think that he thinks that God thinks that we should do this. We should really move on to the questions, but I just wanted to put that in there, that's another aspect that we didn't talk about. There's lots of interesting discussion of that idea in the book. So let's move to questions now. We have quite a few already, so hopefully we'll get through as many as we can. But feel free, if you have more questions, to put them in the box. Actually, I'm going to go to a question here. They didn't put their name, the person asked it, but this is something that was on my list to ask if we had time anyway, which is, there's this paradox that you bring up at the end of the book, which is, you're talking about how this kind of community cohesion idea is so important to religion, and yet religion schism all the time. They throw up new cults and new sects and so on all the time. And famously, I mean, it seems there's a big resurgence in interest in cults. Every Netflix documentary at the moment seems to be about some Mormon cult or whatever in the US. It's a big thing at the moment. And can you talk a little bit about, you know, cults and how it fits with your theory that religions are so they have this schism tendency?
Yeah, I think this just goes back to the fact that religions evolved in the context of, by modern human standards, very small communities. They were really designed to create this sense of belonging and bonding in communities of about Dunbar's number. So somewhere between 1 and 200, which is the natural kind of living group size for hunter-gatherers and small-scale societies and villages. In fact, it was the, you know, still the average size of villages, bizarrely, in the Domesday Book, just 1,000 years ago in England and Wales, when the Normans undertook their census. I think because of that, it's this mystical stance component of this kind of experiential raw feels component plays a very strong role. And in that context, then charismatic individuals become important. So it's very easy for or big religions to create this sort of bubbling up of cults and sects from the bottom, sometimes, you know, with very weird and strange theologies, in which case the powers that be at the top don't like them at all. Sometimes, you know, they take off and they give rise to, you know, brand new major religions. It's been the history of well, really most of the big world religions, and particularly the Abrahamic religions. So it's sort of just part and parcel of the way religion was designed to handle small scale social worlds and is not terribly well adapted to handling a very large scale. It's surprisingly good at generalizing, but it at the last hurdle, it keeps failing, as you might say, and because, you know, sort of a new sect pops up somewhere in the corner of the village and just takes off. But it's a very interesting phenomenon, and it is so widespread, it is unbelievable. But it's almost always associated with ecstatic trance-based experiences. So almost all the suite of Protestant churches as we have them now began life as small charismatic sects with ecstatic experiences, sometimes much to the dismay of their founders even. But I mean, it's the reason the Quakers are called the Quakers. You know, that is not their proper name, Society of Friends. But because it was heavily trance-based very, very early on, and to some extent still is, you know, the quaking bit that was the result of trance got them their label, as they were, which they now live happily with. But it's a direct parallel here with the way languages form dialects. You know, languages have this terrible tendency to spawn dialects like absolute crazy.
Yeah. Well, here's another anonymous question. And actually, this is something you bring up in the book as well. Do you see ideologies such as socialism and nationalism? In the book, you mention the Nazi party and its rituals and so on, which were very, very, very prominent in its kind of brand. Do you see them as performing the same function as religion?
They do, but they don't do it as well. And that's the problem, I think. And what's missing here appears to be this transcendental effect of feeling that you're in direct contact with some greater force, spiritual force. And there's some nice evidence from American 19th century utopian cults, of which there are a very large number, some of which are still with us, like the Mormons and so on. But if you look at their survival times during the 19th century, the ones that had a religious basis to them, almost irrespective of what that religious basis was, survived for about 10 times longer than purely secular ones. There were a lot of secular ones based on Owenite, Richard Owen's ideas. Richard Owen, you'll remember, founded New Lanark up in Scotland, which I'm sure you know very well, having been there many times.
Visited it in school. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, he got fed up with the restrictions being imposed by the government in Britain at the time. So he thought he'd do better in America and wandered off there to set up communes of the similar sort kind, socialist principles. Unfortunately, none of them lasted more than about 10 years. They had a very, very short lifespan, and usually because the charismatic leader ran off with the takings of the money, or ran off with somebody's wife. So one of the two usually happens, and that didn't seem to happen in religiously based ones. And maybe there's a sense there that there's the kind of moralizing high God watching over people's behavior when nobody else can see them does have some sort of effect.
Well, that actually brings us nicely to another anonymous question, which is, it seems that a lot of religions are devised by men in order to suppress women. Discuss.
Yeah, I don't think that's so. I think that a lot of the religions come out of people's particular experiences and cogitations, as it were, and they it gives them ideas which they then try and implement. But at the end of the day, what then seems to happen is they tend to attract women followers in large numbers. And that's the root of the problem. So although it didn't originate as a means of oppressing women in that sense, and shouldn't do so necessarily, there's no reason to expect it, I'm afraid that's one of the frailties and failings of human nature, that it just does over and over again. I mean, it's quite bizarre,
particularly in those cults that we mentioned. It tends to be, and you talk about this in the book, the kind of sexual element with the many wives and the really sort of almost slavery that's happening.
Cults. Yeah.
Jarvis asks, did you speak to religious people when you were doing the research for your book? To what extent does your kind of personal interactions with religious people shape your theory?
I guess it's a combination both of lifetime exposure to different kinds of religion, because I had the, looking back on it, the fortune to grow up in a very multicultural environment in Africa, where I was exposed to very large numbers of religions simultaneously. So you got to know around the edges of these different religions, what their beliefs were, in a way which you really probably wouldn't do, or certainly not at the time, in living in any particular European country where you'd be exposed to one religion within your community. So that was very formative, because it allowed me to sort of notice what was going on. In the end, I suppose we have done projects with congregations of churches, and indeed, my collaborators on this last big project we had that's fed into the book, were all religious people. So most of them were to some degree. So, we have inside views as well as outside views. But at the end of the day, a lot of it is involved trying to step back and not be drawn too much into the details of particular religions in that sense. But I suppose it's true that I've always been interested in religions in general. So, I was reading about different religions from around the world from early teenagehood.
The role of drugs in early and even current religions. So Kate asked a question about that. And you mentioned in the book psilocybin and various other aspects. So perhaps could you talk about how perhaps psychedelic drugs and other drugs have been involved in the evolution of religion?
Drugs of various kinds have a very, very long history, archaeologically speaking, going back, well into the middle of the Neolithic, the Holocene. The archaeological record's very good on that. And so they seem to have been widely used. A lot of these drugs, probably initially, opium, marijuana, the various mushroomy things, henbane, lots of these sort of weird and wonderful well-known drugs, probably began with their medicinal properties and attracted attention because of that, and were being used because they actually did produce, beneficial improvements in health when you were ill. But then they clearly got taken over in many cases for use in religious contexts. So it's extremely widespread, particularly in shamanic type environments, where services, if we give them, use that as a generic term, based on trance, falling into trance. But I think the answer probably, or the explanation for this probably, lies in the fact that a lot of these things actually trigger the endorphin system. We tend to think of them as mind-bending effects, and yes, they do. And I'm sure that's a very entertaining and exciting thing to experience. But what seems to happen, or there is a suggestion that what's actually happening here, is that a lot of them are triggering the endorphin system. It's an over activity of the endorphin system that's triggering trance. So basically what this comes down to is there are two ways of getting into trance. One is the very disciplined calm, measured way of doing it. So you think of Buddhist and yogic meditation practices, which are very hard to learn, but produce the effects very nicely and are very beneficial. And, you know, on the other hand, there's the kind of heavy-handed sledgehammer way, which is very quick, but has invariably has kind of gives you a bad head afterwards, basically, I suppose you might say. But they do, you know, I mean, there's the very famous experiment the US, Boston experiment, where they gave people one of these drugs during an Easter service. It's volunteers, I hasten to add, at the theology department, this was. And the people who were involved in that said the experiences, the religious experiences they had during those services, they have never, ever experienced to the same extent since. They were just amazing and wonderful because they lifted them. I think they were early versions of one of the many psychedelic drugs of the 60s. So, you know, I think it's, you know, drugs give you a quick and dirty way of getting into, as it were, trance states and therefore into what traditionally are then described as getting into the spirit world and having direct mind-to-mind contact with the divine principle or God or whoever you want to label it as.
Getting into the last couple of questions now, say I wanted to set up my own charismatic cult. What is the psychology that makes a cult leader? And then I suppose the second question is that what's the psychology that makes one more susceptible to being a cult member?
Yes. I think both of those are quite difficult questions to ask. People have asked them extensively previously, and there have been quite a large number of attempts to try and study the leadership side of it. Although, as you might expect, on the whole, cult leaders are rather reluctant to expose themselves to close analysis, in partly because I suspect very often they intuitively know that things aren't 100% as they want to describe them, and they don't want to be kind of found out, or they don't want to be found out to themselves. You know, it's you know, if you're told suddenly that your world doesn't work the way it is, it's a major psychological trauma for you. So, you know, naturally, nobody wants to give up their beliefs that easily. But there is a sense in which, or let's say it's quite interesting that a lot of the people who create cults, the charismatic leaders, are loners, slightly kind of off-center on a lot of psychiatric dimensions, as it were. They're not necessarily clinically troubled, but you know, they're a bit more kind of psychotic than the average for the population, that they spend a lot of time wrapped up in themselves. This is very, very common. You know, they'll have some major trauma in life, and they'll retreat into, you know, won't leave their house, or they'll go and hide in a cave or something, and then emerge literally years later, very often, having become enlightened. And I think that's, again, consequence of, you know, being thrown into trance by the things they're doing and by the traumatic experiences at a psychological level. Why people follow, I don't know. I mean, we just do that. We seem to do that all the time. You know, we do it in the context of business. You know, the person who sets up, we won't mention any names, but sets up, you know, some very successful business, becomes a charismatic leader, whether we like it or not. And probably things work better if there is a sense of that, because then everybody who works for them has a commitment to them, and the things work better. But like all these things, a little bit of charisma is good for you. Too much charisma, probably, you know, is a disaster.
Well, that's a good point, I think, to end. So thank you so much, Robin, for the conversation. The book is how religion evolved and why it endures. It's well worth a read if anyone's interested in these topics, even in the slightest. It's full of ideas. Thank you so much to Intelligence Squared for hosting our conversation. And thank you so much to everyone in the audience for joining us tonight.
If you'd like to support us in providing a home for passionate debate, deep discussion, and answering the big questions that really matter, do consider becoming an Intelligence Squared Premium Podcast subscriber today. For just a small amount each month, you won't just be directly helping us continue to do what we do. You'll also be getting exclusive episodes each month, ad-free listening, and early access too. Currently available via Apple Podcasts. You just need to hit the subscribe button. And if you're not an Apple user, don't worry, we're working on something for you too. Thanks for being a listener, supporting Intelligence Squared, and you're just one click away from getting some exclusive extras too.